Devil or angel, I can't make up my mind. Which one you are, I'd like to wake up and find. Devil or angel, dear, whichever you are, I miss you, I miss you.
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from All Things Rock. Today, that includes such sources as ClassicRock.com, BGORecords.com, The News and Observer, The New York Times, iTunes, ClassicBands.com, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening is brought to us by Bobby V, Devil or Angel. We'll be hearing more from Bobby V and about Bobby V later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions. Today's trivia questions are brought to us once again by ClassicRock.com. Classic Rock's Fascinating Facts. Question number one, Bye Bye Love was turned down by Elvis Presley and 30 other artists before who finally recorded it? Hint, it rose to number 2 in the U.S. in 1957 and stayed on the charts for 22 weeks. Bye Bye Love. Question number 2, while talking on the phone with his mother, disc jockey Murray the K mentioned that he and Bobby Darin were soaking their feet after playing a game of softball in Central Park. His mother suggested there could be a song in that. Darin, Murray the K, and his mother, a vaudeville piano player, put the final touches on this song. What was the title of this song? Hint, it became the first of Bobby Darin's 22 top 40 hits when it reached number 3 in the summer of 1958. The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given at the end of today's program. But first, these transition articles. The transition section of today's program is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com. Today in rock history, and today is March the 27th and March the 28th. What were the number one hits this weekend in the past? Well, back in 65, it was the Supremes with Stop in the Name of Love. And back in 68 this weekend, it was Lady Madonna by the Beatles. And back in 1970, Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water. And finally, back in 1998 on this weekend, it was Celine Dion, Let's Talk About Love. If you were born on March the 27th, you share a birthday with Ramsey Lewis, the In Crowd. He was born in 1935 on March the 27th. Also, Tony Banks was born on March 27th. He's from Genesis, born in 1950. And finally, if you were born on March 27th, you share a birthday with Mariah Carey, because she was born on that date in 1970. On March the 28th, well, you'd share a birthday with John Evan. Jethro Tull. He was born on that day back in 48, and also back in 55 on that day, Reba McEntire. Miscellany in rock history this weekend, well, back in 64, it was the pirate station Radio Caroline began broadcasting. Back in 65 on this day, Jeff Beck replaces Eric Clapton in the Yardbirds. And back in 1973 this weekend, Jerry Garcia is busted for speeding on the New Jersey Turnpike. But the $15 speeding ticket turns into $2,000 bail when the police find pot, cocaine, and LSD in Garcia's car. He spends 3 hours in jail. Back in 1987 this weekend, it was Aretha Franklin becoming the most successful female chartmaker in U.S. singles history when I Knew You Were Waiting For Me, her duet with George Michael, becomes her 17th top 10 hit, surpassing Connie Francis, who scored hits between 1958 and 1962. Diana Ross, by the way, had 80 top 10 hits, but only 12 of those were solo. Back in 1991, this weekend, Phil Collins and George Harrison were among the many mourners who attended funeral service in England for Eric Clapton's son, Connor. Back in 1991 this weekend, it was New Kid on the Block singer Donnie Wahlberg is arrested in Louisville, Kentucky. He allegedly set fire to a hotel carpet after pouring vodka on it. And finally, back in 1996, Phil Collins leaves Genesis on this weekend. In contemporary rock news with a local connection, we see this article by David Menconi, newsandobserver.com, published on the February 19, 2010. Rock picks. British accents and melancholy pop rock go together like fish and chips, and so it is with the clientele. The London group's latest album, Bonfires on the Heath, Merge Records, is another fine collection of breezy pop that sounds perfect for dramatic scenes in street cafes, highlighted by frontman Alasdair MacLean's breathy character actor voice and precisely deployed hooks, a highlight of last summer's XX Merge Festival. The clientele's paid a return visit to Carborough's Cat's Cradle in February. Vetiver, opened on that day. David Itzkoff published the next article from the NewYorkTimes.com on March the 11th, 2010. In legal ruling, EMI told, hey, label, leave those tracks alone. There's a picture accompanying it with four guys jumping off the stairs, and it's Pink Floyd's original lineup shown in that picture in 1967, including Roger Waters, Nick Mason, Sid Barrett, and Richard White. Finally, score one for the wealthy rock stars. A British court ruled in favor of Pink Floyd on Thursday, saying that EMI, its longtime record label, could no longer sell songs from its concept albums as individual singles on the Internet, Reuters reported. On Tuesday, a lawyer for Pink Floyd argued in a high court hearing in London that the band's contract expressly prohibited the unbundling of its songs in any configuration other than the way they were originally produced and released. And really, who wants to hear The Happiest Days of Our Lives if it isn't immediately followed by Another Brick in the Wall Part 2? Although EMI had said this did not apply to online sales, Pink Floyd's lawyers said the argument makes no commercial sense. Judge Andrew Morritt sided with the band, saying that its contract was designed to preserve the artistic integrity of the albums, according to Reuters. The judge also ruled that EMI must pay Pink Floyd's legal fees of about $90,000, though a ruling on the amount of the additional royalties the label also owes the band was kept confidential. This next article, also from the NewYorkTimes.com, published on March the 10th, 2010, by Larry Roeder, In Archive and Exhibit, The Dead Live On. The Grateful Dead performed the last of their more than 2,300 concerts in 1995, and thus belong increasingly to history, not the present. Two related events make that reality clear. A new exhibition about the band that has just opened at the New York Historical Society, and the recent creation of the much larger archive housed at the University of California, Santa Cruz, from which it is drawn. There's a picture accompanying this story, and it's a picture of the Grateful Dead in 1966. And it shows Bill Kreutzmann, Ron McKernan, Bob Weir, Jerry Garcia, and Phil Lesh. The Grateful Dead, now playing at the New York Historical Society, which continues through July 4, includes only a tiny part of the material that the band donated to the university in 2008. But as the first large-scale public showing of artifacts from the collection, it offers a tantalizing glimpse of material that is stirring the interest not just of hardcore deadheads, but also of scholars. The items on display include instruments, letters from deadheads, memos from the band's business meetings, newsletters, concert programs, and T-shirt designs. There's also a rare original poster from one of Ken Kesey's mid-1960s acid tests, and even the 1968 letter in which Warner Brothers Records renewed the band's recording contract with a paltry 8% royalty rate for domestic releases and only 5% abroad. Though the Grateful Dead were based in the San Francisco Bay Area and were closely identified with the psychedelic movement that emerged in the mid-1960s there, Louise Mirror, president of the Historical Society, justified the exhibition by referring to the band's great New York pedigree. The Dead first played New York City in June 1967 and went on to perform here more than 150 times, including many shows at the Fillmore East, which Ms. Murr called the band's home away from home. The larger archive at the university, which has received a $615,000 grant from the federal government's Institute of Museum and Library Services, but is looking for additional financing, will have both a physical and an online presence. But even before the archive is fully mounted, the historians, sociologists, anthropologists, theologists, musicologists, and other academic researchers who make up the growing field known as Grateful Dead Studies are eager to plunge in. The article skips down. If I were starting out, I'd find the archive to be amazing as a way to bring a fresh eye and a new perspective to what has happened, said Rebecca G. Adams, a sociologist at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, who has been researching the deadhead phenomena for more than two decades. There are millions of projects people could do. In addition, business scholars and executives are starting to regard the Dead's business model as worthy of examination. This month's issue of The Atlantic includes an article called Management Secrets of the Grateful Dead, and band members have recently appeared on cable television business channels to discuss their consensus-based management style. They had a brilliant business acumen without being business people and may have been the most egalitarian business organization ever, said Barry Barnes, a deadhead and professor at Nova Southeastern University School of Business and Entrepreneurship in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. They are credited with inventing viral marketing, and with their emphasis on superior customer value and use of technology, long before the Internet, they were in tune with a lot of practices we see now. The article skips down. After Jerry Garcia, founder of the band and its lead guitarist, died in 1995, the group gradually wound down its business affairs, a process that lasted well into the next decade. Frederick Lieberman, chairman of the music department at the Santa Cruz campus, had traveled with the band and worked with Mickey Hart, one of the band's drummers, on some projects, including a pair of books. He was aware of the extent of the material Ms. Law had collected and thought that scholars would find it useful if it could be preserved. It was taking up a lot of space in a storage area in Marin, and it looked like they were just going to throw it away, Mr. Lieberman said. I basically said that I didn't care where the archive went so long as it was maintained and not dispersed. Mickey thought first of the Library of Congress, since he's on the board there, but given all the other kinds of things they have to do, their budget didn't seem conducive to the kind of cataloging that was going to be required. The article skips down and concludes with this. I always knew what this was worth, the artwork, the guest list, and all the other things the crew brought back from the road, Ms. Law said in a telephone interview. It was just something that came naturally to me. People in the office would say, we don't need this stuff. Get rid of it. And instead, I would hide it all. So I'm just so happy that it has found a home, the right home. This article, by the way, appeared in print originally on March the 11th, 2010, on page C1 of the New York edition of the New York Times. So who is this artist, Bobby V, that opened today's program and will close it as well? Well, this is an iTunes album review downloaded on the 10th of March, 2010, the very best of Bobby V. Starting out as a sort of a low-cal version of Buddy Holly with the release of the Rubber Ball single in 1960, Bobby V had the looks, the voice, the hair, and most of all the good sense to work with the Brill Building's finest and not rock the boat as he racked up hit after hit in the first couple of years of the 1960s, each one impeccably arranged and conceived. Along came the Beatles, of course, and everything on the pop music landscape changed overnight. But V had his run and made the most of it. This generous single-disc collection has all of his essential high points, including Rubber Ball, the classic Take Good Care of My Baby from 1961, a beautifully orchestrated and arranged Raining in My Heart, also from 1961, the brilliant The Night Has a Thousand Eyes from 1962, and V's late-decade comeback single from 1967, Come Back When You Grow Up, all of which makes this a fine and generous introduction to an unsung, but frequently interesting, and always professional singer. Before we listen to some snippets from Bobby V, there's this article, ClassicBands.com, Gary James Interview with Bobby V. From 1959 to 1970, Bobby V had 38 singles in her Billboard magazine's Top 100. You might remember some of them, songs like Take Good Care of My Baby, Rubber Ball, and Come Back When You Grow Up. In a career that spanned over a quarter of a century, Bobby V has released over 25 albums, yielding 6 gold records. Bobby's big break came when he was asked to join the lineup of a February 3, 1959 concert in Fargo, North Dakota. An opening existed because of the deaths of headliners Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper. Bobby V today sounds as good as ever. And we're not just saying that to be polite. The man can write. The man can sing. His latest release is titled The Last of the Great Rhythm Guitar Players, 1995. We talked with Bobby V about his career, a career that strongly parallels the rise of rock and roll. Bobby, if you're the last of the great rhythm guitar players, there are two guys who are no longer with us who were pretty good in their time, Brian Jones and John Lennon. Oh, absolutely. It was kind of a title with a smile, I guess. I sat around in the studio writing my songs, and the kids would come by and they would say, there he is, the last of the great rhythm guitar players. I never aspired to be a lead guitar player. I loved the rhythm guitar. I still played it through half my show. Rhythm guitar is not as easy as most people would think, is it? It's the most underrated instrument in the band. It's done primarily for fill, and you work off the drums. And it's not a featured instrument in most cases. You got a great review recently where the critic wrote, V is in good voice, good shape, and exudes warmth, energy, and enthusiasm. You were called very much a performer of today. How have you retained your enthusiasm for the music? Are you surprised your career has lasted this long? Well, I'm into my 35th anniversary now. I remember when I was first starting out in the late 1950s, and everybody at that time said rock and roll was going to die. I was 15 years old when I started, and I certainly didn't believe that was true. I thought anything that feels this good and makes me want to tap my foot like this can't be a passing fad like everybody says. Of course, they were wrong. And here we are in the 1990s, and it's alive and well and getting programmed all over the country and really all over the world. So it's been a great journey. There's certainly been some ups and downs, but it sounds like a cliche, and I'm really having more fun than I've ever had. Working conditions alone are better today. We're traveling better and eating better. The equipment is better. Back in the 1960s, we had to play the string parts on Take Good Care of My Baby on a B3 organ. And now we've got all the electronic toys to play with. So that part of it is really fun. And we do a wide variety of shows, so it keeps it interesting. As long as people want to hear the old songs, I enjoy performing them. My job is to make it live every night. I decided a long time ago that rather than walking through it and not enjoying myself, I want to show off as much as I can and be there. This is my thing. Question, Europe must be one of your best fan bases. Yeah, it really is. England in particular. They view America differently than we do as Americans. I think they really see us as a giant jukebox or something. All of this great music that has come out of this century in the last 75 to 100 years. Dixieland music, jazz, and some of the great bluegrass and rockabilly. The pop music of the 60s, certainly the hardcore rock and roll of the mid-50s. This is our music. I think they give American acts points for this. Just by association, they like you, laughs. When you do a theater date in England, we tend to get the people that grew up with the music and their kids, and the people that have discovered it since then. So you really get the diehard fans. Nothing could be more fun to work with an audience that knows your songs, and they even know the B-sides of some of the album cuts. I always in my show reserve a portion for requests, and people shout stuff out of the audience. If the band doesn't know it, I just do it on my guitar and just really have fun with it. That's kind of what sparks me. On the other hand, we'll do a convention for General Electric, and those are unsolicited jobs. You go in to do your show, and people often don't know who's performing until they get there. Everybody thinks they love old rock and roll, but if you ask them to name a song, they'll say, Rock Around the Clock. So you're working for an audience of people that maybe or maybe don't know who you are. That's part of the fun of it for me. You kind of set the ego aside, go out and sing and have fun with them, and that keeps the variety for me. I wouldn't want to have to do it all the time, but it's a lot more fun to work for people who know who you are. You were in England in the 1960s and saw the Beatle thing coming. What did you see? It was probably what I heard. I was over doing a tour, listening to the radio as we do when we're out on the road, and I kept hearing a song by a group called the Beatles, Love Me Do. I heard people talking about this group. You could just feel the excitement going on around them. I loved the record. To me, it had that old 50s sound to it. It had a rawness and an energy to it. It kind of reminded me of the stuff Buddy Holly and the Crickets did. My producer was with me, Snuffy Garrett, and he tried to buy the rights for it for Liberty Records for American issue, and they didn't succeed at that. That sort of alerted me to this English thing that was happening up in Liverpool, the Mercy Sound. I came back the following year, and of course Love Me Do had peaked, and they came out with their follow-up, Please Please Me, and She Loves You. I remember at the time it was like bang, an overnight sensation they were. I remember being invited to a party of theirs in London. The record company or management was throwing a party, and I went back and met the guys in the Mayfair area. And the following day we did a television show together. But they were wonderful, even at that time. It was just all this energy that they had going. There's nothing more exciting than being around acts that finally break through, because they've all got their story to tell about getting there. They had obviously broken through. They had a couple of records that were doing well. They were on the verge of really making it big in America. You lived in California for a good part of the 60s and 70s. Today you live in Minnesota. What are you doing there? Oh, just looking for peace of mind. I loved living in California while we were out there. I cut my first record there in 1960, and I commuted. I was still in school. Finally, in late 61, 62, I had an apartment out there and basically was there until the early 80s. My wife and I and the kids moved back to Minnesota in 1982. It's been a great move. I got tired of California. It was like I had mentally moved 2 years before we packed our bags. We always would come back to Minnesota in the summertime and spend our summers here. Always had a lake cabin. This is beautiful country here in the summertime. Question, but the winters must be hell. Answer, well, they can be, laughs. Living in California and being in Hollywood and all of the hype that goes on, even the people in the business hyping each other, I just got tired of it. Article skips down. What kind of place was Fargo, North Dakota, to grow up in the 40s and 50s? It was America, USA. It was a little small town. It was a city in a stretch of land that was mainly country. It was where all the farmers came to sell their wares. We had a Class C baseball team there. I used to go to all the baseball games. My job was delivering the Fargo Forum. I played saxophone in the high school band. It was just rural America. It certainly was not a place you would go to get into show business. So I was pretty fortunate, he laughs. The article then skips down and ends with this. You toured with both Rick Nelson and Del Shannon back in 85 in England. What do you remember about those guys and that tour? Answer, it was a wonderful tour and exciting time. The English audience was really looking again with the old rock and roll. We did 12 or 13 shows, and they were all sold out. It couldn't have been more fun. It was a wonderful lineup. Bo Diddley was on the show. Frankie Ford, a Marvelettes act. It wasn't the original. It was a terrific show. In 1985, Rick Nelson had made peace with himself and his old songs. It was a joy to watch him perform because he was really doing a rockabilly show. He was really doing his roots of rock and roll. He was singing well. He looked great. He couldn't have pleased the audience any more. So let's listen to a few snippets from Bobby V. We'll start out with The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Then we'll get into Rubber Ball. Then we'll get into Run to Him, and we'll end up today's program with Take Good Care of My Baby. Once again, Bobby V, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes.
say that you're a runaround lover. Though you say it isn't so. But if you put me down for another, I'll know, believe me, I'll know. 'Cause a night has a thousand eyes, and a thousand eyes can't help but see. If you aren't true to me, so remember when you tell those little white lies that the night has a thousand eyes.
And now Rubber Ball.
Rubber Ball, like I'm bouncing back to you. Rubber Ball, like I'm bouncing back to you. I'm like a rubber ball, baby, that's all that I am to you.
Bouncy, 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 bouncy.
Just a rubber ball, 'cause you think you can be true to two.
Bouncy, 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 bouncy.
You bounce my heart around.
You don't even put her down.
And like a rubber ball, like I'm bouncing back to you. Rubber ball, like I'm bouncing back to you.
And now, run to him.
If you found another guy who satisfies you more than I do, run to him. I'll step aside. If you think his lips can kiss you better than my lips can kiss you, run to him. Forget my pride. If someone else's arms can hold you better than my arms can hold you, go to him and show to him all your devotion.
And we'll close out today's program with Bobby B's Take Good Care of My Baby. But first, this review on the NewYorkTimes.com. Ben Cesario, March the 10th, 2010, Lady Antebellum, returns to top of chart. Six new albums entered the Billboard's top 10 this week, but none could best the two titles that have dominated the chart for the last 5 weeks. Lady Antebellum's Need You Now, Capital Nashville, which was released in February and spent its first 2 weeks at number one, returned to the peak position with 126,000 copies sold, according to Nielsen SoundScan. Chardet's Soldier of Love, Epic, the top seller for the last 3 weeks, fell to number two. Hillbilly, Bone, the new album from Blake Shelton, Above My Best Days, the debut album by Danny Gorky, a finalist on American Idol last year, opened at fourth place. And Almost Alice, a collection of new songs by Avril Lavigne, Owl City, and others that were inspired by Tim Burton's new film Alice in Wonderland, is number five. So how'd you do on the trivia question? Bye Bye Love was turned down by Elvis Presley and 30 other artists. Who finally recorded it? And that was, of course, the Everly Brothers were the final recording artist of Bye Bye Love after 30 other artists, including Elvis, turned it down. It rose to number two in 1957. And Bobby Darin was first top 40 hit that resulted from a foot soaking after a softball game with disc jockey Murray the K was called Splish Splash, Take a Bath. It reached number three in 1958.
My tears are falling 'cause you've taken her away. And though it really hurts me so, there's something that I've gotta say. Take good care of my baby.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until...
Just let your love surround her. Paint a rainbow all around her. Don't let her see a cloud. Once upon a time.
next time.
No, she'd never be with you, so take good care of